This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to patella fractures and scaphoid fractures, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with patella fractures, and the first question reads, a 46-year-old male sustains a patella fracture and is treated with cannulated screws and a tension band construct. Which of the following is correct regarding this treatment? And the choices are 1, knee flexion arc is restored to the contralateral side, 2, extensor lag is recovered by 15 months postoperatively, 3, implant removal rate can be as high as 50% or more, 4, quadriceps strength is not limited at long-term follow-up, and 5, patients with retained implants have pain scores equivalent to healthy norms. So fixation of patella fractures with tension band constructs leads to a need to remove implants in over 50% of cases in multiple studies. So the correct answer to this question is 3, implant removal rate can be as high as 50% or more. Tension band constructs result in absolute stability when performed correctly. This technique works by converting tension from muscle pull into compressive force on the articular side of the fracture. Tension band constructs require a fracture pattern or bone that is able to withstand compression, an intact cortical buttress opposite to the tension band, and fixation that withstands tensile forces. LeBrun and Associates evaluated functional outcomes of surgically isolated patella fractures. They reported that 52% of patients underwent surgery for hardware removal, and 38% of patients who retained their hardware reported pain at some time. They also found that nearly 20% had extensor lag, and almost 38% had restricted flexion. Extension power on testing showed significant mean deficits when compared to the contralateral side. Bayer et al. Evaluated 20 patients with patella fractures and found that articular incongruity of greater than 1 millimeter was the largest risk factor for quadriceps weakness at a mean of 30 months postoperatively. No significant differences were seen with sex, fracture pattern, or time from injury to surgery. Moving on to the next question. The dominant arterial blood supply to the patella enters at which anatomical location? And the choices are 1, proximal pole, 2, mid-lateral, 3, mid-medial, 4, directly anterior, and 5, the distal pole. The largest arterial contribution to the patella will enter at the distal or inferior pole of the patella, with the dominant artery entering inferomedially. So the correct answer to this question is 5, distal pole. The arterial blood supply to the patella is made up of branches of 6 main arteries, the descending genicular, the superior medial and lateral genicular, the inferior medial and lateral genicular, and the anterior genicular. Several of these branches contribute to the anastomotic network that surround the patella. From the ring, there are 2 main interosseous blood supply systems to enter the patella, known as the midpatellar and polar vessel systems. The distal pole of the patella is considered to be the largest arterial contribution to the peripatellar ring and the polar vessel system. Lazaro et al. Used 20 matched pairs of fresh frozen cadaveric knees to isolate the dominant blood supply to the patella. After cannulating the superficial femoral artery, anterior tibialis artery, and posterior tibialis artery, and performing magnetic resonance imaging, they found that the largest arterial contribution to the patella entered at the inferior pole in 100% of the specimens. In 16 specimens, or 80% of the specimens, the dominant artery entered the medial aspect of the distal pole. In 3 specimens, or 15% of the specimens, it entered the lateral aspect of the distal pole. And moving on to the final question for this topic, partial patellectomy is the recommended treatment for which of the following injuries? And the choices are 1, vertical patella fractures, 2, bipartite patella, 3, severely comminuted inferior pole fracture, 4, stellate patella fracture, and 5, chronic quadriceps tendon rupture. So partial patellectomy is a recommended treatment for a comminuted superior or inferior pole fracture measuring less than 50% of the patella's height that is not amenable to ORIF. So the correct answer to this question is 3, severely comminuted inferior pole fracture. Comminuted patella fractures are challenging to manage. Older studies show that in severely comminuted fractures, partial patellectomy is the recommended treatment. Newer studies are showing improved outcomes with ORIF. Therefore, if possible, proceed with ORIF. Unfortunately, when the comminution is severe, ORIF is often not possible and partial patellectomy is required. The area can be excised and a technique of quadriceps tendon or patellar tendon repair can be undertaken. Saltzman et al. Reported maintenance of range of motion and strength up to 85% of the contralateral side with partial patellectomy at an average of 8.4 years follow-up. Marder et al. Showed that change in patellofemoral forces is minimized by attaching the patellar tendon / quad tendon anteriorly on the remaining patella. Their study also showed that by resecting more of the inferior pole, that contact stress increased as the size of the discarded portion of the patella increased. Matichik et al. Report in a retrospective study of 71 patients that either had basket plate osteosynthesis versus partial patellectomy that osteosynthesis by basket plate provides better clinical results. They recommend this technique if possible. And moving on to the final topic of scaphoid fractures, the first question reads, which of the following carpal pathologies would be best treated with medial femoral condyle vascularized bone grafting and open fixation? And the choices are 1. Chronic lunate osteochondral defect, 2. Acute scaphoid fracture with humpback deformity, 3. Proximal scaphoid avascular necrosis, 4. Scaphoid nonunion advanced collapse with scaphocapitate arthrosis, and 5. Stage 1 Kienbach disease. So out of the available options, vascularized medial femoral condyle graft and fixation is most commonly used in the treatment of proximal scaphoid avascular necrosis and scaphoid nonunion, making 3. Proximal scaphoid avascular necrosis the correct answer to this question. Free vascularized bone grafts are often considered in the management of carpal bone nonunion. Various donor sites exist, including the distal radius, iliac crest, ribs, and femoral condyles. The benefits of vascularized bone graft techniques include increased bone perfusion over time, accelerated graft consolidation, and rapid repopulation by cells. However, a relative contraindication for their use is in the setting of carpal bones without an intact cartilaginous shell or advanced carpal collapse with degenerative changes. Al-Jabri et al. Reviewed the use of the free vascularized bone graft for nonunion of the scaphoid. They noted that the union rate in medial femoral condyle vascularized bone grafts to be 100% in 56 patients. They state the descending genicular vessels are most favored due to their longer nature and their wider caliber. Jones et al. Reported on the treatment of scaphoid waist nonunions with associated avascular proximal pole and carpal collapse. They showed better clinical results with medial femoral condyle bone grafting compared with distal radius vascularized bone grafts. To quickly go over the incorrect answer, answer 1 is incorrect, as chronic lunate osteochondral defects may be treated non-operatively with observation only or arthroscopic osteochondral grafting with graft harvested from the lateral femoral condyle. Answer 2 is incorrect, as acute scaphoid fractures with humpback deformity rarely require free vascularized bone grafts with initial treatment. Answer 4 is incorrect, as scaphoid nonunion advanced collapse with scaphocapitate arthrosis is a relative contraindication for free vascularized bone grafts and wrist salvage procedures. Pancarpal arthritis is usually managed with arthrodesis. Answer 5 is incorrect, as stage 1 Kienbach disease does not require open fixation techniques. Vascularized bone grafts can be utilized for stage 2 disease and potentially for stage 3A disease. The most commonly used vascularized bone graft for this disease is based on the 4th and 5th extensor compartmental arteries, although many other techniques have been described. Moving on to the next question. A 21-year-old male underwent percutaneous screw fixation of a non-displaced scaphoid waist fracture 7 months ago and now presents with persistent radial-sided wrist pain. His skin wounds are well healed. Basic radiographs of the wrist show maintained hardware position. What is the next best step? And the choices are 1. Clenched fist stress radiographs, 2. Bone scan, 3. MR arthrography, 4. Fat suppressed T2 weighted MR imaging, and 5. Fine cut CT scan. So after percutaneous screw fixation of a non-displaced scaphoid waist fracture, the best imaging study to assess for union is fine cut CT scan of the scaphoid along the scaphoid axis. The etiology of chronic pain symptoms after dorsal percutaneous screw fixation of scaphoid waist fractures include fracture nonunion, fracture pseudoarthrosis, loose, migrated, and/or broken implants, as well as extraosseous factors, for example, neuroma. Fine-cut CT scans have shown to be the most specific imaging study to assess for fracture union after technical errors have been excluded with basic radiographs, for example, inadequate screw size or poor screw position. Ring et al. Reviewed acute scaphoid fractures. They state that surgical treatment is recommended for displaced and complex fractures, for example, open fractures, perilunate fracture dislocations, and scaphoid fractures associated with fracture of the distal radius. Other recommendations for surgical treatment include variproximal fractures and fractures for which the diagnosis and treatment have been delayed. Lutsky et al. Suggests that scaphoid nonunion is conventionally defined by no healing of the fracture greater than 6 months after fixation of the injury. They state that CT scans are most useful for diagnosing scaphoid union, but they are unreliable for ruling out nonunion. Yin et al. Examined the cost-effectiveness of multiple competing diagnostic strategies for suspected scaphoid fractures. They state that immediate CT and MRI were the most cost-effective strategies for diagnosing suspected scaphoid fractures. Moving on to the next question. An 11-year-old boy sustained a fall onto his outstretched right hand while playing soccer. Examination reveals tenderness in the anatomic snuffbox. Wrist radiographs reveal a scaphoid fracture. This injury most commonly presents with which of the following? And the choices are 1, within the distal one-third of the scaphoid, 2, within the middle one-third of the scaphoid, 3, within the proximal one-third of the scaphoid, 4, in association with injury to the scapholunate ligament, and 5, as a unicortical injury. So the distal pole of the scaphoid ossifies before the proximal pole, resulting in an increased incidence of distal one-third fractures and avulsions of the distal radial aspect of the scaphoid, that is 59% to 94%, as compared with adults. So the distal pole of the scaphoid ossifies before the proximal pole, resulting in an increased incidence of distal one-third fractures and avulsions of the distal radial aspect of the scaphoid, as compared with adults. So the correct answer to this question is 1, within the distal one-third of the scaphoid. Scaphoid fractures in the pediatric population can be seen in association with distal radius fractures, but are not commonly associated with ligamentous injury. While 23% of pediatric scaphoid fractures are unicortical, bicortical injuries still predominate. Most pediatric scaphoid fractures are non-displaced and heal with 4 to 6 weeks of immobilization. As in adults, displaced fractures are treated with open reduction and internal fixation. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following statements is true about force transmission based on wrist position? And the choices are 1, neutral wrist position decreases force through the lunate fossa. 2, extended wrist position increases force through the lunate fossa. 3, neutral wrist position increases force through the scaphoid fossa. 4, extended wrist position increases force through the scaphoid fossa. And 5, wrist position has no effect on force transmission. So with the wrist extended, force transmission is shifted to a greater extent through the scaphoid and the scaphoid fossa. So the correct answer to this question is 4, extended wrist position increases force through the scaphoid fossa. The position of the wrist can change the pattern of force transmission across the joint. With the wrist in neutral, force is transferred across the joint via the lunate fossa and scaphoid fossa almost equally, with a slight predominance to the scaphoid fossa. However, with the wrist extended, force transmission is shifted to pass even more via the scaphoid fossa and less via the lunate fossa. This is a proposed explanation for scaphoid fractures resulting from falls onto an outstretched hand with the wrist extended. So the correct answer to this question is 4, extended wrist position increases force through the scaphoid fossa. Majima et al. Tested force transmission through the wrist in different positions in a three-dimensional rigid body spring model from CT images. They found that force through the scaphoid fossa increases from 52% to 62% with extension of the wrist, with a p-value of less than 0.05. Similarly, in the midcarpal joint, force transmitted across the scaphoid increased from 60% to 69% with a p-value of less than 0.05. Weber et al. Performed a cadaveric study of wrist injury. They found that with the wrist extended, the force applied to the palm was increased 4 times as it transmitted across the scaphoid. They described the waist of the scaphoid as a location of concentrated force and theorized this is why waist fractures are common in injuries with the wrist extended. Moving on to the next question. An open dorsal approach for antegrade screw fixation of a non-displaced scaphoid waist fracture differs in which of the following ways compared to a percutaneous dorsal approach? And the choices are 1, decreased risk of proximal pole AVN, 2, increased risk of posterior interosseous nerve injury, 3, decreased risk of injury to the APL tendon, 4, increased risk of injury to the EPL tendon, and 5, decreased risk of screw prominence above subchondral bone. So scaphoid screw fixation should be just below the subchondral bone, and this is best judged by direct visualization. Adamani et al. In an anatomic study using fluoroscopy to insert a scaphoid screw via a percutaneous approach found that the scaphoid screw was prominent above the subchondral bone in 2 of 12 specimens and flush with or buried in the remaining 10 specimens. As a result, they recommended using a limited dorsal incision to verify full seating of the screw. In addition, they found the percutaneous approach was within 2.2 to 3.1 millimeters of the PIN, EDC, and EIP. Thus, all of these structures are at increased risk of injury in a percutaneous approach. Tamilti et al. Inserted a Herbert screw through a dorsal approach in 12 cadaveric wrists. They then imaged them with AP/lateral x-rays and 360-degree fluoroscopic views. The wrists were then dissected to evaluate for subchondral penetration, and plain x-ray films were accurate in 5 of 6 specimens. Fluoroscopy was accurate in all 6. They concluded that fluoroscopy during placement of the Herbert screw may decrease the rate of subchondral penetration. So the correct answer to this question, asking about an open dorsal approach for antegrade screw fixation of a non-displaced scaphoid waist fracture and how it differs compared to a percutaneous dorsal approach, the answer is 5, decreased risk of screw prominence above the subchondral bone. Moving on to the next question. A 21-year-old man reports wrist pain after a fall. He also reports that he sustained a wrist sprain the previous year. Radiographs reveal a waist scaphoid fracture with a non-union, humpback deformity, but no evidence of osteonecrosis. What is the best choice for surgical treatment? And the choices are 1, volar approach, standard bone graft, Kirschner wire fixation. 2, volar approach, standard bone graft, screw fixation. 3, volar approach, vascularized bone graft, Kirschner wire fixation. 4, dorsal approach, vascularized bone graft, and Kirschner wire fixation. And 5, dorsal approach, standard bone graft, and screw fixation. So the patient has a scaphoid non-union with humpback deformity. Surgical treatment should include correction of the humpback deformity with bone graft. This is best accomplished with a volar approach, non-vascularized bone graft, and screw fixation. So the correct answer to this question is 2, volar approach, standard bone graft, and screw fixation. Since there is no prior surgical treatment and no evidence of proximal pole osteonecrosis in the patient in the question stem, the use of a vascularized bone graft is not necessary or recommended. Whereas both dorsal and volar approaches have been described, the humpback deformity is most easily corrected via a volar approach. This exposure allows for insertion of the Kirschner wire joysticks to help correct the deformity and allow easy insertion of the bone graft. It also preserves the main dorsal blood supply to the scaphoid. Kirschner wire fixation of the fracture itself has been used in the past, but screw fixation is more secure. Fractures and non-unions close to the proximal pole may be better visualized with the dorsal approach, but correction of any deformity can be more difficult. Vascularized bone grafts are usually indicated for failed non-vascularized bone grafts or in the presence of osteonecrosis. So the correct answer to this question is 2, volar approach, standard bone graft, and screw fixation. And moving on to the final question for this review session, percutaneous screw fixation for non-displaced scaphoid waist fractures has been shown to have which of the following differences compared to closed treatment? And the choices are 1, increased direct and indirect cost, 2, slower return to work, 3, higher union rates, 4, reduced time to fracture union, and 5, improved motion and grip strength after 2 years. So fixation of non-displaced scaphoid fractures with a percutaneous screw has resulted in a shorter time to union, that is 6 to 7 weeks versus 10 to 12 weeks, and faster return to work or sports. Aurora et al. Found the indirect cost reduction by a quicker return to work was shown to offset the direct costs of surgical intervention. The operatively treated group had a better mean dash score than the conservative group. Fracture union was seen in the screw fixation group at a mean of 43 days and in the cast immobilization group at a mean of 74 days. Bond et al. Found in active military personnel there was faster healing but no difference in ultimate union rates or final grip strength or range of motion between percutaneous screw fixation and non-operative groups. The average time to fracture union in the screw fixation group was 7 weeks compared with 12 weeks in the cast immobilization group. There was no significant difference in the range of motion of the wrist or in grip strength at the 2-year follow-up evaluation. So again, the correct answer to this question, asking about percutaneous screw fixation for non-displaced scaphoid waist fractures compared to closed treatment, the answer is 4, reduced time to fracture union. That's all for this question review session about patella fractures and scaphoid fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.